Blog Talk Radio.
All right, you're listening to The Unknown Show. I'm your host, Bud Smith. On today's show, we're going to have two guests. We're going to talk to Kay Razor, who is the publisher of Punk Hostage Press, and he's a great poet in his own right. I currently have about 6 books of his poetry. Really great guy. I call him from Northern California today. And then later on, we're going to talk to D.R. Haney, known to his friends as Duke Haney. Duke is the author of the novel Banned for Life, among others. Great guy. He was just visiting from L.A., and we had a good old time kicking around New York City. So, yeah, all right. Speaking of New York City, snowing. Snowing a lot. I actually got told I don't have to work tomorrow, so that means that the drinking pretty much starts right about now. It'll be a night of drinking, talking, shooting the shit. To everybody listening, I appreciate it. I hope you find these interviews as interesting as I do, and that you get some great info from some new people you might not know much about. As always, this show is live on Tuesdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And I usually interview writers, musicians, artists. So if you got something you'd like to talk about, send an email. Follow me on follow the show on Facebook. It's probably the easiest way, and just send a message. This Thursday is going to be another show. Usually I only do one on Tuesday. We're going to talk to Chuck Howe, author of If I Had Wings, These Windmills Would Be Dead, out from Unknown Press. And we're also going to talk to Andrew Ink Fiend and Keith Baird about their new dual poetry book that just came out from Piscataway House. All right, so I'd like to get this show on the road here and introduce a Razor. He's holding on the line right now. I mean, one second here. I have a whole bio I'm going to read. I'm usually so unprofessional. I usually don't even have that stuff. But A. Razor was born in Brooklyn in 1963, but he's been a California native his whole life. He was first discovered by Drew Blood Press in 1984, where he published 11 chapbooks up to 1995. He fought hard to live and express his art in many different ways and in many different places. He became a member of the Hollywood Institute of Poetics in Los Angeles, California in 2009, and he has participated recently in the Poets in Prison panel at Beyond Broke and the 2011 Aloud Reading Series in the downtown Los Angeles Public Library. In 2012, he teamed up with Iris Berry to launch Punk Hostage Press, on which they have released 5 of A. Razor's own work, and he has edited 9 more titles from just as many writers. So he's also collaborated on book design covers and graphic artist Jeff Melville for many of the books. In 2013, the nonprofit Word Just Works began to expand the outreach work in prisons, homeless shelters, jails, and juvenile detention centers. So it's a pleasure to say hello to you, A. Razor. How you doing today? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing good.
Yeah.
How you doing?
How's it going? Okay, I'm doing pretty good, man. I'm just, you know, vastly different circumstances. I'm just, you know, looking out my window at all this fucking snow. What's going on over there in California?
It's not snowing, but, you know, it's kind of funny because I was talking with somebody out there earlier today, and, you know, I was, like, born in Brooklyn when, like, a similar kind of storm hit, like, you know, back in 60, like, 50 years ago. So whenever the city gets hit with something like that, it just always kind of reminds me of the day I was born, even though I don't remember it so well.
Well, that's pretty cool to remember the day you were born. You know, I was born on Thanksgiving Day, 1981. So they gave my mom a turkey dinner in the delivery, not the delivery room, but where the new mothers go. So I usually eat pumpkin pie and turkey on my birthday, you know.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, can't complain about that.
Yeah, you can't.
Hey, do you think that I think generally New York people, East Coast people, like, whenever we get a little bit of weather here, you know, it's like everybody, you know, shut the fuck up about it. It must seem so funny, you know, California ways, you know, listening to, you know, all these people freaking out over a little snow, you know, to get a life, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of, I think it's one of the reasons my mom left New York when I was, like, 1 year old. She grew up in, like, Texas and New Mexico, so she was kind of, like, you know, after 10 years of being in New York City, she was over the winter, and, you know, having to do a single mom with a kid back then, she was, like, you know, I got to go somewhere warmer, so she came to California.
Yeah, that's where everybody wants to go. Me and my wife, we must talk about moving to California, like, every week. Got family in San Diego and L.A. and Bay Area, so it's like, you know, throw a dart at the map, and maybe, who knows, maybe one day get out there. I'd like to start talking to you right away about your book. I've been reading your book, Better Than a Gun in a Knife Fight. I really dig it. I really like your style. Can you kind of talk a little bit about? I mean, you said you've been on this globe for 50 years now, 50 years of A-Razor floating around. Started out in a snowstorm, and now you're where you are now. How have you seen your writing change over the years? How did you, has it changed over the years? Or do you think you're still
it's always kind of been about process for
sure.
Me. I think when I started writing when I was younger, it was, you know, without being conscious of it, I was trying to develop a process. And then, you know, as I met people that would mentor me, that's the type of mentors that I met early on, were people that were, you know, stay out of the results and, like, stay in the process of it. And it'll carry you, you know, it'll become a vehicle for you. It'll become, like, a place you can go when you got nowhere to go. And that's what it was early on, you know. I was like a homeless kid back in the late 70s, early 80s, and so writing was a way for me to process not just like my thoughts into words, but also how I could deal with the, you know, the environment that was difficult. And, you know, it was, I know a lot of writers don't like to say that writing's therapeutic for them, but I got, you know, I'm not ashamed to say that it was very therapeutic for me early on, and it continues to be. It's kind of, I credit writing with why I'm still alive.
Well, that's something to say right there, that that it kept you alive, man. I bet it really did, didn't it? Now, when you say that that's therapeutic, I don't deny that one bit. The whole idea of pretending it doesn't do something for you, for a person who's As you talk about, man, being, like, involved in the actual process of doing it, the actual process of creating, not so much your short-term investment on publication or whatever that really even means, you know? Just getting almost a meditative joy out of it, you know? Problem-solving from within, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the writer's, like, I really got bit by the bug around, you know, in 1979, I went to my first reading to get on stage and read, and also there was a featured reader there. There was actually two featured readers, and the main featured reader was Wanda Coleman. So that was, like, my first exposure to people, to writers getting together and sharing their work. And, you know, it was kind of a baptism into, you know, what the process looked like in a community. And I wasn't, you know, I didn't, like, really take to it right away because my writing process was real personal and I did it in an isolated kind of way, and I would continue to do that for many years. But, you know, just knowing that there was a community out there that I could sometimes connect with was important. And it was, you know, it has been. I mean, I would have just been a guy that wrote alone in a closet or a jail cell, and nobody would have known about it if I didn't know about a community of writers that existed.
There's always a community of people. I think, like, what you just touched on right there is really a lot of people might identify with that, you know, the whole thing of writing is such a solitary thing, and you think that maybe a lot of people think that what they're writing isn't for mass consumption, but mass consumption is such a strange thought. The community is what it's about, you know, the community reaching out. You can walk around your block, knocking on doors, and you'll probably find writers who would be eager to share with you, you know. And I admire that.
Yeah.
I admire that about people like you who start up these great communities and are gathering people together to do good work together. You know, I would give you a shout out, Punk Hostage Press. I think it's doing some cool stuff, man. I really do. I was checking out Reardon's book last month, Frank Reardon's book, and I really dug that, Blood Music. So congratulations on the work you guys did on that and all its success. You know.
Yeah, I mean, that was you know, I met Frank when he came through L.A. I was introduced to him by S.A. Griffin, and S.A. had been one of those people that I had kind of been mentored by from early on, and I watched him. You know, I could never do what S.A. did. He was like a spoken word artist, and that's not really me. I've done spoken word things, but I don't really consider myself like a spoken word artist that gets up there and like wows the crowd and everything. But, you know, just knowing someone like that over the years and seeing how SA really, you know, when writers come through Los Angeles, SA is there. He's like part of that community that's been there for a long time. You know, he's a big supporter of Beyond Baroque, and he's always reaching out to writers, especially young writers. And, you know, that's from people like him and Wanda Coleman and Richard Modiano and, you know, Iris Berry and Amelie Frank and Laurel Ambolian, like writers who've been around L.A. for a long time that I watched. Luis Rodriguez is a big mentor to me. You know, from watching writers like that and how they cultivated community and how they were always, you know, trying to create spaces for people to share stuff, that influenced me and affected me in a way where I wanted to be a part of giving back to it.
Yeah, that says something. That really does say something about going to a reading, watching someone perform, watching how they do it, reading their work on the page, comparing and contrasting the two, and getting what you do from maybe the high of seeing all these people, interacting with all these people, and like we talked about, his community. So, yeah, man, I definitely dig that. Before we get too deep into more into chit-chat in here, I'm wondering if I can get you to read some stuff. I think, you know, some people would really dig if you read some poems.
I could read something. Let me I'll read something from Better Than Again. This is called Fixer. She took pictures of me while we were in love. She took pictures of us while we were in love. Pictures that she developed herself in a lab off of Telegraph Avenue, where she rented time and chemicals to do so. She took pictures of me staring off into space, worried about final outcomes and doom that was looming overhead in the shadows. She took pictures of me drunken and fighting with the neighbors in the street, knuckles all bloody with teeth all bared. She took pictures of me attending public demonstrations that I would turn into riots, that would turn into photographs of cops in riot gear guarding a fallen comrade. She took pictures of me tying off and injecting what I took to be sanity into my waiting bloodstream that recoiled from the pulsating madness of my torn-up reality, that dropped into frame like confetti thrown into the universe from another world. And another time when someone would take photographs of me now as I look out a window, wondering whatever happened to all those old pictures of insanity? And does it really matter now that I have someone shooting pics of me while we are in love, and doom is just a memory as she takes pictures of me while she sits cross-legged and naked to let me know I am safer now than I ever was or would be as long as she is holding the camera and all I have to do is look out the window so I can remember to forget about all the photos that are lost in the past that no longer matters, washed away in fixer and blood and teardrops, flooding away a black and white world so long ago.
Well, that's just a lot right there, man. That's a life encapsulated in a poem right there.
You know, that was just kind of, relationships are a huge part of, I think, why all writers write, you know, because it's like in the ability to create, you can reflect on the damage you've done or the good things that you've done, and you can also try to project into, you know, what the outcomes you want to create. And, you know, that's something that writing can, like, really help you do. It can help you save relationships. It can help you fix them, you know. And it's like being able to have snapshots of emotions, you know, in each poem.
Yeah, damn right. Can I get you to read another one?
Sure. This is from a book that just came out a few months ago, and it's available online, and all the proceeds go to help Words is Works, which is the nonprofit you were talking about, where we take readings into different homeless shelters and jails and prisons and give books away to the people there and try to start up creative writing programs. So this is called Number 19. Art is stolen off of lips of those who speak it, as it was created long before those who have seen it, heard it, felt it, tasted it, taken from the minds of those who never even knew it existed. It was created before it was experienced. It was experienced before it was created.
This is from that's a poem from the book Half Century Status, which I'm looking at right now. And as you just said, I'll repeat it for people listening. Proceeds from purchase of this book goes towards the Words is Works program. That's pretty badass. You're talking about getting books in prisons and institutions and stuff. I read that and I was like, holy shit, that is fucking awesome. What a thing to try to do, you know? That's awesome. I applaud you on that. Most people I seem to know are like, you know, ecstatic with getting their book in Barnes and Nobles. But I think that is fucking great, man. Fucking, if you can get a book in the hands of somebody who really needs it, that's what books are for, you know. A book will save somebody's goddamn life that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know that from personal experience, you know. I mean, I've been
Yeah.
And it's like having a book was, you know, like I said, that shit will keep you alive. And you know, so I try to get back to that and the best way I can now, you know. And I'm, you know, it's a half century status. It's about me turning 50. It's 50 poems. They're basically written like status updates on social media. And it's $7. You can go to punkhostagepress.com, and, you know, every bit of the proceeds that doesn't go to the printing, you know, it's a print-on-demand book. So, you know, like I think $4 or something for every copy goes directly to buying books for inmates and people in homeless shelters. And also, Iris is working on starting a program of getting books to written by women writers to women and women's shelters And I work in a shelter for women who are, you know, single mothers being reunited with their children after domestic violence, and CPS gets involved and separates the family. So that's kind of what I do on the side, is I work in that field. And, you know, so giving people books is like one of the best things I think you can do, because in this technological culture, you know, poor people really don't have the capacity to support like Kindles and things like that. But if you give them a book, yeah, you know, it doesn't take no batteries to run a book, and they can hold it and keep it. And so
it's
pretty important going.
Yeah. I mean, you know, public library and education, you know, it's a little different. It's definitely different when you're talking about in a shelter, you know, but I think it's great. It's great to actually see people, who actually go to the library and get a book out of the library. It's like free, man. It's right there. Take a walk down the street. So what else is going on with Punkasi's Quest this year? Yeah, what's coming up? I don't know if you care to talk a little bit about some projects that are coming or anything of that nature at all.
Well, we'll have two books coming out this weekend that were, you know, are technically our first releases of 2014. A book from Ed Stokes, who's a San Francisco writer, called A History of Broken Love Things, and a book from Joel Landmine, who's also from San Francisco, called Yeah, Well. And technically our first 2014 release is Alexandra Naughton's book, I Will Always Be Your Whore, the Billy Corgan love songs. And, you know, even though I finished it in December, it's like technically our first release of 2014. So those are the first three books that we got coming out. We got a book by A.D. Winans, which is a prose book, you know, about his lifelong relationships with people like Jack Michelin and you know, Bukowski, and you know, some of the people he met back in the San Francisco Renaissance scene. I mean, you know, A.D. Winans has been around, and you know, he was really close with Bob Kaufman, so there's a lot in there about Bob Kaufman and him. And you know, it's just a really intense book with a lot of information about, from a guy who was there, you know, who's really given that perspective of what it was like to be there. We got Iris has some books coming out that she's written. Disgraced Land, which is a book she's doing with Cleven Gaiman, which is about like a famous punk rock crash pad in Hollywood in the 80s where she lived there with Pleasant, and it was like a lot of people came through that pad. MTV filmed, it became so notorious that MTV like went there in the mid 80s and filmed like a little spot there, just because so many, you know, people that were in bands and stuff would go there and crash while they were in town. And so it's like a lot of real good stories of that whole scene and that time. And then we have a book by Lee Quantstrom, who was one of the Merry Pranksters, and he was like real close with Ken Kesey, and he was also a really renowned journalist back in the 60s and 70s. And then he also became like one of the main editors for Larry Flint's Hustler magazine, and he was the guy responsible for a lot of those political op-ed pieces that were in Hustler magazine. And, you know, he was there when Larry Flint got caught the bullet and got paralyzed. So it's a real interesting biography in that book. And we got another book coming out by Jack Grisham, the lead singer from TSOL. We put a book of his short stories out last year, and we're putting a limited edition book with the pictures and a short story that he wrote based on the song Code Blue that TSOL did back in 1980. Or actually, I think that song came out in 79 or 78. But, you know, it's a real, you know, it's a cool little thing. And we got a lot of writers that, you know, Kimberly Kim, who's this amazing writer who also works with us in the nonprofit stuff that we're doing a lot. She's a big supporter of the press. She's got this novel that she's finishing up. We're going to put out. It's like a really amazing accounting of a Korean-American student that goes to Korea, and, you know, it's the cultural exchanges and stuff that go on. I don't want to give it all away, but it's just an amazing piece of writing. So we have so many other writers. I mean, we literally have books slated into 2015 that we've already got the manuscripts and we're working on. We got a book from S.A. Griffin that's going to come out in March, and him and A.D. Winans are going to do a book release party down at Beyond the Road in March. And, you know, we just keep pushing to really bridge all the communities that we can, and like get as many other presses involved in our Words is Works project, and we're just always growing. You know, we only been around 2 years, and we just keep growing. And you know, we had so many good books that came out last year: Dennis Cruz's Mockwing Tea, and you know, Frank's book, you know, Frank Reardon's Lead Music. And so many good books in the first year that we were out, you know, Rich Ferguson, Anthony, and Yvonne De La Vega's, her book, Tomorrow Yvonne, you know, Iris's book, The Daughters of Bastards, you know, and I put out a few books. So it's like, I mean, we've just been really working hard, you know. We got Candy Ocelloni out of up there in British Columbia. We put a book of hers out in the first year, and Carolyn Shrigley Moore, you know, put a book of her poems out in our first year. You know, we just keep coming into these quality works, and we got so many more. So I hope people just continue to pay attention to what we're doing, and you know, maybe we'll even grow our readership more, because we got a lot of really exciting stuff. You know, it's not just poetry. We're putting out novels, short story collections, and you know, actual nonfiction stuff that's, like, real interesting, so.
Well, that's what I'm getting from your press, man. You know, I'm glad you talked extensively about all these titles coming out, and it's really cool because I think you're right. You definitely are kind of touching on there's something about style you can't really, you know, you can't really explain or even, you know, teach. I think Punk Hostage Press Books bleed style, you know. I got kind of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I got 7 of them sitting here in front of me. And I want to talk a little bit more about you're talking about you put out a few books last year through PHP, and I'm looking at one now in particular that I'm just like kind of like enamored with the cover of Beaten Up, Beaten Down. This is a really, really cool looking book. Who did the book cover on that, or is it something that just came together?
That was one of those things that I worked with Jeff Melville on. I kind of came up, you know, I was thinking Saul Bass, and I just sketched something down quick, and I shot it off to him, and then he tightened it up real nice, and it's just. It's kind of like my homage to Saul Bass, you know. And the manuscript was like one that I had that I've been working on for a while, and it just kind of really reflects on, you know, my life as a writer, that like 30-plus year arc that I've had as a writer and now editor and a publisher, and just, you know, a lot of different styles. And basically, you know, a lot of things where I've critically taken my lumps. I mean, I didn't publish from 95 until 2012. I just kind of, like, went underground. You know, I missed this whole technological leap that everyone made. I kind of stayed away from that. I didn't get on the Internet until, like, about 2007 or so. And, and you know, and then I just kind of, I've just kind of been using the Internet to connect with old friends and make new ones. And, you know, really me and Iris were only going to put out a couple of books, and this thing just mushroomed. It just, like, blew up, and we're just kind of riding the wave, you know, trying to make it into the most positive experience that we can.
Yeah, that's the vibe I get from you guys. It seems like, you know, when you're doing a publishing
juncture, and you're putting books out, and you're doing it. Because how you're talking about earlier about the whole process, you know, the process of writing. Well, I was talking to a guy the other day on the show here. His name is Joseph Quintella, and he was talking about publishing as art. And if you're going to treat publishing as art, then if you get involved with it in the same manner of the process of publishing, not the end result of publishing, good beautiful things happen. And I think you guys are definitely doing some great shit, man. Props to you.
Yeah. Thanks, man. You know, we're gonna keep at it, you know, until someone stops us, I guess.
Yeah, until somebody stops you. That's fucking funny. Hey, dude, can I get you to read one more poem, please?
Yeah, I mean, I could read something from I'll read something from Beaten Up, Beaten Down. This was when I was putting the manuscript together, me and my significant other she lost the pregnancy, and you know, it was pretty intense emotionally, and I kind of just, you know, after going through all night, I just wrote a poem to kind of as part of the process of dealing with it. So this came out of that, and I put it in the book because it was just so powerful, and she was like, yeah, you should put this in the book, even though it's a real painful subject. This is called News That Hurts to Talk About. The woman I love is okay so far. She will bleed it out. Blood leaves, hopefully. Her life stays. Hopefully, love stays. Still, for now, there is gratitude for what is left, even for what is lost. This is what can't be run from anymore. Hopefully, something is left, maybe even stronger after the blood is done running out, somewhat, and for the most part, for what is left, for what stays behind, hopefully.
Well, that was something else, you know. when you write about stuff that's tough to the heart, then I guess it kind of gets down to what poetry and writing is for in general, you know. I want to thank you for coming on the show, man. I appreciate it. It was good to talk to you. And you were talking before about, you know, avoiding technology. You know, you avoided technology for so long, and now, you know, you started floating around after a long missed the whole electronic boom, and now you're connecting with old friends and meeting new ones online. And I got to say, the thing I dig the most about the internet is just, you know, when you get a chance to run across somebody who you meet on meet online, you get to meet them in person. So hopefully I'll get to catch you out there AWP if you're going to be floating around, man. I'll come by and give you a good old handshake, all right?
Yeah. I mean, we had a table last year. We didn't have the bread to get one this year. But, you know, who knows?
I'm going to make a cardboard cutout of you, and I'm going to take it with me everywhere I go, all right?
Yeah, do that. Some of our writers will be up there, so, you know, we'll definitely be represented. And, you know, who knows? I might win a lottery or something and drive up there and, like,
you
can just pull it up. But,
all right, man.
You know, if not, we'll cross paths soon, man. I appreciate the chance for me to talk about what I'm doing. And thanks for, you know, giving us a venue to talk about it.
Yes, man. Well, good luck to you and all your stuff and all the Punk Hostage Press stuff to come. And I'll talk to you soon. All
right, bud.
All right. So that was A Razor. For people just tuning in, he's the publisher of Punk Hostage Press, a poet with a whole lot of good stuff to say. Rather than, you know, you read my poetry, it's all gibberish. He's the kind of poet, you read a poem and you walk away with some knowledge, all right? And it seems to be that they're doing some good work there for a lot of people that could use some help. So support the cause, man. Punk Hostage Press, click around, okay? Next on the show, we have Duke Haney. Duke is a pretty cool fuck, man. He is the author of the novel Band for Life and a nonfiction collection, Subversia. His birth name is Daryl Haney, but you're his friend now, or you guys, you can call him Duke. And he's calling from L.A. He's a writer, actor. He's known for some really cool movies. We'll get into that in a little bit. And I'm gonna pull him on the show here and see what he has to say. Hey, Duke, how you doing, man? What's going on?
Oh, Bud?
Yeah, what's up,
can
man?
You hear me?
How's it going? Oh, I can hear you. I can hear you, man.
Okay. It's a little weird because, you know, while I was waiting for you to pick up the phone, I was listening to your conversation with A. Razor.
Yeah.
And I kept wanting to, like at one point he mentioned that his press has books coming out by Rich Ferguson and Yvonne De La Vega. And I was like, oh, I know them.
yeah.
But I forgot that I couldn't be heard.
Yeah, you were so, like, I do that shit all the time. I'm just driving around in my car, you know, and I'm talking to the radio or whatever, and I'm not even on hold. So yeah, I don't feel bad, man. That's great. So yeah, he's a California guy, just like you. You're pretty much calling from Hollywood right now, aren't you?
Well, I'm calling from Echo Park. He lives out here too, huh? Does he?
I forget what
the fuck Razor?
He now.
Does he live, or does
yeah.
he, you know, does he live in the,
I think he,
in the Southern California
the
Gulag? Oh, in
the Bay
Area.
Area,
right, okay, right. Well, that's a little bit better. I'm going up there this weekend, as a matter of fact.
You know, my problem is, Duke, I can't even fucking remember where I live. I come home to the city, and I just wander in a five-block radius around where I think I live, and I just look at the doors, you know, so I can't recall where anyone lives.
Well, I know where you live.
Yeah,
and,
you've been here. You've been here. It's like a fun
house. I don't look at doors. I listen to them. Kadoom doom. Bad, terrible joke.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
can we start over?
We're good. So I pulled you on the show because I was just reading this great – I'm reading Banned for Life, and I want to talk about it a little bit if you're not sick and tired of talking about it yet.
No, not at all.
I wanted to talk to you a little about the book and what's going on with I guess the world. I don't know where I was going with that. So I want to set your book up here for people listening who are looking for something to read. Well, here it is. Here's something to read. Banned for Life. It's the New York and L.A. punk rock and X-List Hollywood. The culture wars of the 80s and 90s. I'm reading from the back here. Jason Killer Maddox weathered them all for years, and he was haunted by the mysterious disappearance of someone he barely knew. The person he barely knew was this great, like, cult-like punk rock figure that this dude just gets like almost obsessed with tracking him down. And this is a fucking great book, man. It's heavy enough to kill a small dog with, but entertaining every step of the way.
I'm happy to report that I have not attempted to kill a small dog with the book.
Yeah, you know, you find the right kind of dog, and believe me, you'll be tempted. You haven't met the right kind of dog yet.
Well, I've been tempted to kill myself with the book, but no animals to date.
My God, wouldn't that be something? Man found dead by his own book.
Yeah, well, I think in less literal ways, I think that happens all the time. There's nothing like doing battle with a book, particularly a novel. Novels are, you know, they're at least in my experience, are particularly tough to write. But anyway, so Banned for Life. What do you want to ask me something, Bud? Ask me something.
I'm gonna keep asking. I'm gonna keep asking you all these stupid questions.
No, they won't be stupid.
Oof. Now I feel like I'm under a giant weight of pressure here. the main character. I want you to describe for people who listen, kind of set up the main character, talk about him a little bit, and explain where he starts out and where he's going.
Well, I don't know how far into the book you are, but you're talking about Jason, right? The protagonist
Jason,
of the book?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jason Maddox is his name, and he is a very grew up a very typical sort of guy, you know, sort of all-American jock type guy. You know, was probably headed to college in a rather sort of ordinary life. Although he was a bit lost, and that had to do partly with his socioeconomic status. He went to school at a place with a lot of rich kids, and he sort of always sort of felt like he didn't really quite belong. And there was sort of a big scandal that happened to him when he was 18 years old. You know, I mean, I'll just, you know, tell you, I mean, he slept with his girlfriend's mother. It's a long story how that happens, but, or how it happened, but, and there was a whole, there was a chain of events that led to him getting expelled from school, and then thrown out of his house, basically. He was arrested at school, and thrown out of his house, and he ended up, crashing with he was working as a busboy at a steakhouse, and he ended up crashing with this Latin guy who worked at the steakhouse. And one of his neighbors was this 15-year-old kid named Bernard Mash, who was himself kind of in exile from New York City. He grew up in Brooklyn Heights, and even though he came from you know, his parents were sort of well off, but sort of quasi bohemians. His father was a playwright and a screenwriter, and his mother worked in publishing. But even so, he was had always had behavior problems, I guess we'll call it. His parents had talked about, in fact, having him institutionalized because he was just sort of given to outbursts and stuff. But really brilliant, brilliant, brilliant kid, like off the map kind of brilliant sort of kid. And was, you know, really into punk rock, and he and Jason became these very unlikely friends, and he and Pee Wee turned Jason onto the punk rock, and this was sort of in that, you know, that time that was when hardcore was sort of getting started. You know, the first wave of punk rock had died, and everyone was sort of, you know, the mainstream media had declared it dead. And you know, some of the old punk bands were now being sort of marketed as so-called new wave, because punk was sort of poison. It was thought to be, you know, sort of a poisonous label and for a band or a performer to have. And so, you know, there was this sort of, you know, the second wave of punk was just starting up in America. It was hardcore. In England, it was Oi! And so, there's another sort of, you know, scandal that never quite becomes one that kind of launches Pee Wee and Jason into moving to New York, and they live in the Lower East Side. This is back when that was a very dangerous place, as I can testify firsthand. They're in a number of bands, and you know, they have the usual sort of you know, adversarial relationship sometimes that people in bands can have, you know, Lennon and McCartney and, you know, Keith and Mick and all that, you know, and eventually they patched things up, and they, you know, had finally kind of learned how to collaborate. And then there was this really, you know, really, really awful accident that happened while they were on tour, and three people were killed, and Jason sort of narrowly survived. And so in the aftermath of that, he decided he wanted to become a he didn't want to go back into music. So he made a film, and the film went to Sundance, and though it was never distributed, it got him an agent. So he moved out to LA to pursue a failed directing career.
So it's really cool, you know. Now to people listening, what Duke just said right there, it's not really spoiling the book so much as if you start in the beginning here, it's all kind of laid out, kind of in rapid little great little snippets, almost as like addictive writing. You know, you're reading and it's like, oh, all right. Well, here's the end of this little snip. I got to keep going because what's happening next? He's not really blowing up the plot of the book so much as just This all happens pretty much within the first 25 pages. But I want to say, I think so far I'm out in the book. It definitely, the things you touched on with, like, talking about the punk scene, the hardcore scene, and just like encapsulating this whole feeling of the CBGB's New York kind of scene thing, mixed in with this great underground movie kind of thing. This is, like, you're talking a lot about the main character he's gets into making this one particular film that was the one that went to Sundance and
Sick to Death.
I dig it. Sick to death.
I didn't know at the time that I came up with a name for it, there was an Atari Teenage Riot song called Sick to Death. But I liked that the initials are STD, sexually transmitted disease.
Sure.
Just like Jim Cassidy's band of the novel is called Rule of Thumb, and it turned out there really was, of course, a band called Rule of Thumb, which I didn't know at the time. But, yeah, exactly. It comes after rot. So it's STD,
yeah.
Sexually transmitted disease, rot.
All the good stuff. So, yeah, all the good stuff. You know, kids today are kind of missing out. You know, high school kids are missing out because now I just heard that it's sexually transmitted infection now. STI is what they're teaching the kids now. They're not calling it a disease, which, I love the sound of STD. What a great, horrible thing
to
talk about.
Right? I guess disease is too loaded a word for people nowadays because people are such shrinking violets now that, they're so easily upset and offended. So if I guess if you talk about disease,
yeah.
That
I don't have a disease. I have an incurable infection. Shut
right.
Up.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So that's Band for Life. I talk a lot about books on here. I think I kind of got to get a fucking life. I just keep reading all these books, these great books, and I want to recommend your book highly. I think people should pick it up. Go click around, Band for Life. Click on all the places.
Well, I
appreciated
the photo that you put of it. You put up a photo that you took of it next to a lot of empty paint cans,
yes.
Or at least one empty paint can. And I like the picture. I collect, people are always taking pictures of my book and sending them to me. I guess this happens to all writers now. And so I collect them. I actually even put up a little piece somewhere online where I just, the piece is just, a collection of some of the photos that people had sent me of my book,
I love the book photos. I had a girl post a photo of, a novel of mine, and she was reading it on a beach in Cuba, and I was like, yes, my book's in fucking Cuba. I want to go there, get me to Cuba.
Somebody did send me a picture of themselves reading my book on a beach,
huh?
But the beach was, I think, in New Jersey. I don't think it was in, it definitely wasn't in Cuba.
So New Jersey,
I think you won that particular contest.
I've only won one contest, and there's a zillion. I actually did win. I won one writing contest in my whole life. I don't really believe in writing contests, but I sent a poem to a place, and I didn't realize they were having a contest, and they mailed me $75, and I couldn't fucking believe it. I had to read the thing a couple times. I was like, wow, they really sent me $75. And this was the first time I ever really, really sent a poem anywhere. So I remember telling, she's my wife now, she's my girlfriend at the time, I said, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to fucking send poems all the time and make all this money, And, that didn't really work out, That was it, one-time deal. But
I think I saw an old movie about a woman who supported her family by entering contests. I can't remember the movie, but she would just, every contest, and that she in a magazine, it would be like mail this in and enter this contest, and so she just, she made a living by entering contests.
She did every single one.
What was
she
the
did
movie?
Every single
so,
goddamn contest. Yeah.
Right.
I'd love to do that. I remember when Coca-Cola, their bottoms of their caps always had codes on them, and I was like, oh, my God, all these Coca-Cola caps. I should just sit at a computer at the public library and enter them all in and rake in all my winnings. You know, it would just be like, if you did it long enough, it would be like $100,000 worth of Coca-Cola products, you know. I got the Coca-Cola beach bag, the Coca-Cola beach towel, the Coca-Cola T-shirt, hat, you know, Coca-Cola car, all that shit. But,
well, I guess if I were a NASCAR driver, that would be pretty cool. But as it is, I would hate to be a human billboard for Coca-Cola because I never touch the stuff. Not to sound puritanical, but I have health problems that preclude my my drinking Coca-Cola. So
yeah, rock on. Rock on.
All right,
you
I will.
Go wrong with, you can't. Yeah, you have to. So now I want to talk a little bit about you're still doing screenwriting. You've acted in movies. You've made movies, and I always thought that was cool. I wound up meeting you online through mutual friends of ours, and I wanted to talk to you briefly. I know you're probably so fucking tired of talking about this.
No, that's all right. You know, it's never the same.
It's
never the same conversation twice.
Yeah, oh, exactly. I know. So,
I mean, and you know, it's not like I do a radio interview every day. You know, I do one every decade, maybe.
Yeah. You just do a bunch of drugs before the show. You're like, I'm totally numb. Just ask me the questions about Friday
I wish,
the 13th Part 4. Actually, Friday the 13th Part 7, The New Blood, and it's got my most memorable scene from my childhood of. Jason Voorhees finds some teenagers in the woods, and he zips one up in a sleeping bag and beats the shit out of him against a tree and kills him. That's when I was a little kid. I figured I was going to go to college for that and make a career out of killing people with zipping them up in sleeping bags and killing them. That didn't work out, but
well, it's not too late, bud. I it seems to me that we have a dearth of serial killers now in America, so it's not too late to make a career as a winning serial killer. You know, we talked about that when I met you.
Yeah,
in the old the Band for Life stomping grounds, the Veselka. I've had many a bowl of borscht at the Veselka at 4 a.m. the sleeping bag death, I was telling you about that. You know, I can tell you how I ended up writing the movie or how I got that job or whatever. I mean, I was, you know, very young and it just kind of fell into my lap. I could go into more detail about that. But that particular thing, you know, when I got the job, I mean, one of the things I sort of, you know, kind of had to do was to make a list of ways to eliminate, you know, all of these naughty campers at Crystal Lake, and to come up with, you know, new methods of, you know, it's death porn, you know, it's violence porn. So I looked at all the movies and was like, oh, they used the potato peeler already. And they used, used a lawnmower already.
Yes.
They've used, you know, a weather vane. They've used, you know,
so great.
So I had to kind of make, you know, a harpoon, you know, a juicer. I kind of was making a list of like all the ways that people had not been killed in these movies to date. I was actually even calling people like, do you know of any like tools that you could use to like kill somebody in a Friday the 13th movie? When I was a kid, I was the oldest kid and I had a couple of younger siblings and we went camping a little bit and I remember having this idea, you know, that I could just sort of stuff one of my siblings down into his or her sleeping bag and just pick it up and like swat it, you know, against a tree and like, you know, I mean, not like an impulse to kill or anything. It just was this kind of, you know, odd thought that darted through my mind. And so I, you know, remembered this thing, and I put it into this script, and I never thought about it. You know, I didn't think it particularly stood out from the other deaths in the series or anything. And I never really saw the movie in its entirety until a few years ago when it, you know, I was out of the country when it came out, and when I came back to the country, it was playing. This is back in the days of New York when. Times square was still a place where like a lot of homeless people would watch kung fu movies and talk to the screen, you know, and also, you know, horror movies and x-rated features, and I happened to be walking, you know, by I was walking up Broadway, but I happened to see that Friday the 13th Part 7 was playing on this triple bill with a couple of other movies, and I walked up and it was already sort of in progress, and so I ducked in and I saw part of the movie and I didn't see the Sleeping Bag Death, but and it was really, I thought, really awful. I thought the movie just was, you know, like it was even worse than the screenplay, which is saying a lot. It had been rewritten after I had left the project anyway, but.
Yeah.
So I never thought about it, and then I guess about 10 years ago, I was friendly with this band, and You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead, an appropriate name in light of the subject matter. And
sure.
I was on their Yahoo group, if you remember Yahoo groups, I didn't even know if all, you know, like I knew two of the guys in the band, but I didn't really know all of them that well, and although I'd hang out with some of them when they came to town and stuff, and somehow they had found out, I guess it was through IMDb, that somebody had thought to look me up online or something like that, which, you know,
yeah.
I'm surprised that anybody would have taken the time, and they posted on this group that they said, hey Duke, are you which Friday the 13th movie did you write, or was it a Nightmare on Elm Street movie? And I was like, busted, you know, because I would never admit that I had, you know, written one of these movies. I wrote Part 7. And then, like, immediately, like, a couple of people on this Yahoo group popped up and said, oh, did you write The Sleeping Bag Death? That's my favorite Friday the 13th death ever. So
yeah.
I finally learned that this death had been voted, like, the number one, you know, like, you know, among Friday the 13th fans, it had this sort of, you know, prestige or stature, which you know, I you know, it was, it really surprised me, and that's even with the death truncated. I guess originally, you know, that Jason slammed this girl against a tree, you know, 10 times or something, and then in order to avoid an X or an NC-17 rating, whatever it was, the movie was cut quite a bit, and so he only slams her, I think, once. So
yeah,
there you go.
So yeah, there we go, man. Fucking, that's some crazy shit. You know, we were at Bazelka's, and we had a real long talk and ate a lot of borscht. But first of all, I want to say
cabbage.
That stuffed cabbage. Yeah. Anybody who's coming to New York, I know you're all coming through New York sometime this year. Pretty much you all are. I'm only saying it because there's probably about 50 people listening, so 25 of you at least are coming through New York. Go to Vizelka's, Lower East Side. It's 24 hours, and it's a Ukrainian diner. Fucking awesome, man! What a great place. But while we were shooting the shit, we touched on something that was pretty intense, and it was it's actually kind of documented on the cover of your book of essays, Subversia, which is it's essays gathered from stuff you published on the Nervous Breakdown, which,
most of them.
Not all of them, but Nervous Breakdown is a pretty great site. But the essays in it are I'm really a fan of your essays too, as like a completely different thing than the fiction book. Dan for Life is great. The essays are so cool because it's just like this very visceral thing. And talk about visceral, the cover of Subversity is you after a major fucking hit by a car on Sunset Boulevard, right?
I didn't really write about it very much in the book, though. I mean, I think I mentioned it in passing, and Brad Listy, the publisher, wrote a he and Greg Ollier are another novelist. They both wrote sort of forewords to the book, and they both, I think, mentioned, I think Greg even mentioned, because that's how I got my name after the accident. People calling me Iron Duke. The iron refers to the titanium rod in my right leg, and Duke was because according to the person who gave me the name, I now walk like John Wayne, he said, after the accident. So eventually that got shortened down to Duke, but some people, there was a group of, I had some friends who called me Iron, so it was either Iron or Duke, you know. I've never been able to figure out how to write about the accident. I don't want to just write a thing saying, I had an accident. Whenever I write an essay, I'm always trying to get it something larger, even if I'm writing about, lately I've been writing about well-known people. About Jim Morrison and, a piece about Lee Harvey Oswald, but I'm never just writing about Lee Harvey Oswald or about Jim Morrison or about Errol Flynn, Sean Flynn, or Marilyn Monroe or any of these people I've written about. This is all for another collection. I mean, I'm always trying to get at something through that person, and I was never able to figure out how to put the accent into a larger context. But I was, in a nutshell, I was run down. I was run down by a car on, as a pedestrian on Sunset Boulevard, right outside the present day site of Amoeba Music, one of the last record stores in America, appropriately. Yeah. And I was in the hospital for 6 weeks, and my lower right leg had to be reassembled, and my right arm was, I never even saw my leg. I think I was telling you that I got thrown by this car like 20 feet or something, and I landed on the sidewalk, and I never lost consciousness. But I raised my head, and blood was pouring out of my mouth, and I looked at my arm, and my right forearm was like literally, it was like if you bend a straw, I think I may even have done that when I was demonstrating to you. It was like the hand part was my right forearm was just completely snapped in two, like my hand was like hanging from, the snapped end of the bone, and this black guy was leaning down in front of me, I looked up at him, and he was looking down at me with, I guess, compassion. And he said, "Your leg is bad, man, real bad."
Yeah. Yeah.
So I already knew, because I was literally the fender of the car that hit me. I mean, that was the part of my body that it connected with. It connected with my right, my lower right leg, my shin, my right shin. So I knew already. I definitely felt the pain, but I knew it was bad. But there's nothing like hearing confirmation. From someone when you're lying shattered on a sidewalk. But the ambulance arrived very quickly, and then I freaked out in the ambulance on the way to the hospital because I heard the medic say that there was no pulse in the leg. I mean, I'm very lucky to have a leg. I'm very lucky, period. I'm very lucky to be alive, It was something, you know. And I, you know, sometimes I probably have a touch of you know, PTSD from it. But you know, I knew, obviously, you know, working in the film business, I had, you know, most of the people I knew were worked in it, and then the next night, that first night I was in surgery for like, I don't know how many hours while they were sealing me up, and then they put me in the intensive care unit or whatever, ICU, and then they moved me down to a room, and you know, I think I was still on morphine at that point or whatever, but some of my some of my friends came by, and this woman who was a director, they were trying to take pictures of, you know, to document what had happened, because it was, you know, clear that, you know, I would end up in some sort of litigation, and she took pictures of me, and then I had a friend who's now a very well-known director of photography, a cinematographer, and he said, no, and he took the camera away from her, a couple of photographs of me, which looked very painterly, and yeah. But he was really just trying to document, you know, the scrape on my eye, you know, the one side of my eye was like completely, you know, it had been, you know, bruised to the point where it was completely red, but I've had people look at the book and say things like, oh, well, you know, if I was in a really bad accident, the last thing I would want is to have somebody come to the hospital and take glamour shots of me. And I'm like, well, yeah, that wasn't the idea. It's just, it just so happened that I had like a, you know, a really great DP who was, you know, who knew how to capture the, you know, get the light just right. I can't help it that I'm so handsome that it looks that it looks like a glamour portrait, you know.
The correct thing to say when someone says something like that is, you know, the actual last thing I would want when I'm in the hospital with my leg shattered and my arm bent like a straw is to have a circus midget come and blow me or something, you know. Somebody take a couple photos, you know. Big whoop.
Well, I might have considered, a blow job, but not from a circus midget. Okay. Now I think, have we crossed the line here? Can we start over? Can we rewind?
Oh boy. Well, you know what? This show is always a fucking train wreck. I started out really nice with Eraser. He was, talked about some legitimate, awesome, great stuff, and now all of a sudden I'm asking you about getting blown by circus midgets towards the tail end of the show. That's just, you know, the way things.
Well, I will tell you, as a funny thing, I did have a nurse. This was at Cedars Sinai Hospital, where I had Screen Actors Guild insurance at the time, and people would actually even come into the room to like compliment me on my insurance. They go, "You have great insurance." And then, of course, later I had a big battle with the Screen Actors Guild about my bills and stuff. One of my nurses, and nothing happened. I one day she came into the room, and I mean, I had people visiting me or something. But out of the blue, she just sort of mentioned that she had been in Playboy. She like they had done like a spread on like nurses. I think I remember that issue. Only in LA, right? You have a nurse who, you know.
Yeah, a Playboy nurse.
I mean, the only thing that would have been more LA would have been, you know, to have a nurse talk about, you know, her acting career.
I know. I got different friends, you know, periodically who moved out for a little while or they're there for good, you know. And they all have these stories that just sound so, like, if I was to invent the stereotypical LA stories, you know, I'm like, wow, this is fucking. I don't know if I can give you too many broad. I don't consider them hardcore New York stories. New York doesn't exist anymore. New York is gone. You know, LA is still very much alive.
Jesus, I could give you some hardcore New York stories. I mean,
I know you could. You were here when it was New York. it's not New York anymore.
Well, it was evolving when I was there, and by the time I
yeah.
left, I mean, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, that I left was really that I sort of felt like it was no longer New York. But, you know, people get mad when you say that. I mean, the people who live in New York now, you know, seen as, you know, nostalgia and
sure.
and, you know, and you date yourself. And of course, the greatest crime in America, you know, is to of all, the greatest
you
cultural
yourself,
crime
right?
is to be over the age of 40 or whatever, you know.
Unless you're a writer. There's nothing.
No, writers too, definitely. No, you have to be 25 to do anything in America. You know, it's you're forbidden to be any older.
You're crazy.
To do anything. I think that the LA mentality is you know, it creeps uh-huh. into, like, you know, everywhere. You know, through the media that we disseminate. I think it's even on the software, which is a California product. You know.
Yeah.
You know, the California sensibility, you know, it's like kudzu, you know, is that the right word? You know, like the creeping ivy.
Oh, fuck yeah. It's a weed that grows on the side of the road in Georgia in like an hour. It gets like taller than a house.
It's a contagion. So we spread, you know, I guess this is what they mean by Californication, but that emphasis on youth and beauty, you know, it's everywhere now. You know, I mean, that's why there's so much emphasis now on the red carpet. You know, like nobody even, you know, like, you know, awards. It's just I don't remember this when I was a kid. It's everybody's just like obsessed with like who's wearing what on the fucking. I'm like, I don't give a fuck what somebody's wearing on the fuck. You know, Jesus, shut the fuck up. You know. It's all anybody talks about anymore. Like, you know, like I used to say Yahoo's, you know, I have a Yahoo account. Yahoo has changed their account, but I used to say literally it's like, you know, like life could be discovered on Mars and this life on Mars could declare war on the Earth. And the head Yahoo story would have been, you know, Lindsay Lohan bombs on the red carpet.
Yeah,
I mean, that's how obsessed people used to be with, like, you know, or still are, actually. I think that obsession stands. But we're obsessed with how things look. That was the point. We're, you know, everyone is utterly superficial now because we look, you know.
Well,
okay,
you know.
I'm ranting.
No, you're not ranting, actually.
You know, no, I am. I am now. You got. I've been holding back, you know, from going into full rant mode
uh-huh.
You know, but hey, you know, punk rockers, including former punk rockers, are known for ranting, aren't they? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, isn't that part
of what
we do?
That's why you're on my list of favorite people here, Mr. Duke. You're talking about beauty.
Oh, well, thank you, bud.
You're talking about beauty, and you're talking about people's obsession with it. I got into the interesting conversation about Marilyn Monroe, who seemed like
I'm embarrassed.
A big,
well, you know,
big,
somebody stole my line. I mean, you know, somebody stole my line. There's
uh-huh.
a great line in Sam Shepard's play, Fool for Love, and in the movie, the character was played by Harry Dean Stanton, and it's
uh-huh.
one of the all-time great lines. I think he says at one point he's not really there, Harry Dean Stanton, and he says to Sam Shepard in the film, he says, "I am married to Barbara Mandrell in my mind." Do you understand? I am married to Barbara Mandrell in my mind, and I do have a Marilyn Monroe fixation. In my mind, I am married to Marilyn Monroe. You know, she's not dead.
Yeah.
She didn't die 50 years ago. She
yeah.
is alive, and I am married to her in my mind.
She is so alive.
So I think I did go into a thing about her with you.
Yeah, she's on the couch smoking a cigarette, and you're doing the dishes because she's so great.
Oh, no,
you know,
no, she quit smoking. We settled
okay.
that right away.
Good.
I don't even know what I said.
Up.
I think I did, because I wrote about her, you know. I wrote about her, in the course of doing that, I did a lot of research and stuff like that. So this knowledge is still, like, all floating around in my head, you know, I haven't been able to quite get rid of it.
Well, you know, I'm gonna.
So it jumps out at odd moments, like at the Veselka. I suddenly will go into a thing about, you know,
sure.
I'll, you know, I don't know. Marilyn Monroe did this or that. You know. anyway, go on.
No, man. I was just saying.
As a punk
walker,
I'm supposed to be obsessed with Betty Page, right? But I'm not into the Betty. You know, I'm I'm more into the I have the Marilyn Monroe upset. You know, they're buried in the same cemetery, by the way, or
Betty Page
encrypted
and
in the
Monroe?
Case of Marilyn Monroe. But yeah, Betty
really?
Page is buried is in the ground about 30 feet from Marilyn Monroe, and she's
Holy
buried
shit.
There because Hugh Hefner, I think, arranged for her funeral, and of course he has the crypt above Marilyn Monroe. He's going to be basically atop Marilyn Monroe for eternity.
Get the fuck out of here.
I think it's really telling that he didn't want to be married. He didn't want to be buried with, like, his wife.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't want to be buried, next to, with his family or, you know.
Uh-huh.
He's going to be buried up, basically above his first centerfold, a woman he never met. It's just so perfect that, you know, that he's going to spend eternity in this sort of fantasy position, you know.
I guess that's what we're all – I'm not going to say we're all aiming for that, but I think
in America, we all live a fantasy existence. I mean,
yeah, right.
That's why I'm not really interested in movies anymore. I mean, because it's just all about fantasy, and everyone just wants everything fantasy all the time, all fantasy all the time. You know.
Yeah. No.
And,
no hyper-realism.
No. I'm still a gritty reality guy, and that's extreme. It's one of the many ways in which I'm. Completely unfashionable and will never have any reading or following or, you know, of any kind ever in my lifetime. Or ever, really, because we poison the well to make sure that this never, ever comes back, you know. Gritty realism, we salted the earth to make sure there never is such a thing ever again, except on, like, you know, these television shows that everybody in the world watches except me. And then they're gritty reality.
Yeah, things go in cycles, obviously. You're right on track to be very popular the day after you die, okay?
Well, you know,
just like,
I try.
Just
but,
like all
know.
Of us, right? Yeah. You know what? I gotta say, the show's kind of coming to a close here, and it's...
Yes, I know, sucks. I know. I was about to say, I hope I'm not preventing you from closing the show, bud. I'll let you close the show, and I'll just say that it's been a pleasure to be on it, and I think that I'm an ideal guest for the Unknown Show because I am completely unknown. You couldn't have come up with a more unknown guest to be on the Unknown Show than me.
I think that's complete bullshit, by the way, and I think that when I said Unknown Show, where that came from was the people who run this fine network asked me what the show was going to be called. I didn't have a name. I was like, you know, it was like the day of, and I was like, oh, well, the name's unknown, and that's where it goes. So now I kind of cringe when I invite people on the show. I also hope I'm not insulting anybody. You know, like, this is a show for people who you don't know who the fuck they are. But anyway, we got some Jesus Christ, man, we covered a lot of ground tonight. All the great projects that you have going on, and projects for the future. I know you're working on a bunch of a bunch of new essays and stuff that are
I'm trying to get a whole bunch of, I have a you know a whole bunch of those things I'm working on. I'm going up to San Francisco this weekend to research into another one about another but I'm not going to be writing about well-known people for now. I'm going to be writing about more obscure figures and it's too difficult to write about really super famous people. Because they're, you know, so it's just very hard to find anything that hasn't been said about them already. So,
Well, I'll tell you what, the people on the fringes, I always find the most interesting, and
me too.
I look forward to reading your coverage on the rest of the fringe.
Well, thank you very much, bud. As I said, it's an honor to be on the show, and I'm going to shut up now. Once
Jesus
and for all.
Christ. You know what? I'm gonna send an extended invitation here. I'm gonna drag you back on here before too long. So go out there, experience, talk to some fringe fuckers, and I'll force you to come back on and tell us all about it. Okay?
All right. Well, thank you very much. I look forward to being forced.
All right, buddy.
And,
take care, man.
All right. All right. You
later.
Too.
All right. So, I think that was a pretty fun time. We talked to E-Razor. Talk to him about some really great stuff that he's got going on with the Punk Hostage Press and his programs to get books in the hands of people in institutions and prisons. I urge all you guys looking for some great poetry to go to the Funkastic website, and first and foremost, take a look at A. Razor's books. I got fucking six of them sitting here. I read a couple of the last week, and I got to say, there's some great stuff. Great stuff in there. Also, Funkastic Press, I want to also plug out for Frank Reardon's book again, Blood Music. Fucking awesome book. And also, Alexandria Norton's book, I Will Always Be Your Whore, which is it's a series of poems written to Billy Corgan, based around certain Smash and Pumpkin songs. It's a great little slice of Cesaro art. Love that shit. And I want to give a special thanks to Zucchini for coming on the show and telling us all about his great novel, Dance of Life. What a fucking book. Yeah, I hope you guys all check it out. Check out Duke's other books, Aversia essays. He's an interesting guy, man. He's led a cool life. He writes about it like he talks about with gritty hyper-realism. So, you can't go wrong there, you know? And once again, I hope you'll check out the show on Thursday. We're going to talk to Chuck Cannell, author of If I Had Wings, These Windmills Would Be Dead. We're going to talk to him about his new book, about some different shit he has going on. And we're also going to talk to Keith Baird and Andrew Inch Beaton about, they have a dual poetry book out from Scatterly House. It just dropped the other day. It's at the book release party in Jersey. And these guys do the craziest, funniest, they do like a haiku death match. So I'm going to try to reenact that on the show. For those of you who aren't aware, haikus can be fucking funny as hell. So I hope we can get that going. So thanks for listening, and I hope you have a really great weekend, all right?